Trembling, it was in his eternal appeals to bankers. In the beginning, we had to go to the banks, almost on our knees, to get money and credit. When dealing with the banks, he vacillated between caution and daring. He often went to bed worrying how he would repay his large volume of loans, then awoke in the morning refreshed by a night's sleep and determined to borrow even more. The Civil War introduced a new greenback currency and national banking system that generously stoked the post-war economy with credit. Many people grew rich with borrowed funds, creating a false flush of prosperity. Rockefeller was very much a product of this new credit-based society and owed a great deal to Truman Handy and other Cleveland bankers who identified him as a young businessman of exceptional promise. He cleverly projected the image of a rising star whom bankers spurned at their peril. One day, he ran into a banker, William Otis, who had allowed Rockefeller to borrow up to his credit limit. Some directors were now expressing misgivings. Could Rockefeller stop by to discuss the loans? "I shall be very glad to demonstrate the strength of my credit at any time," replied Rockefeller. "Next week I shall need more money. I would like to give my business to your bank. Soon I shall have a great deal of money to invest." Obliging but never fawning, he knew how to soothe jittery creditors, and one of his cardinal rules was never to seem too eager to borrow. With amusement, he recalled how one day he was walking down the street, trying to figure out how to find an urgently needed $15,000 loan, when a local banker pulled up in a buggy and serendipitously asked, "Do you think you could use $50,000, Mr. Rockefeller?" Rockefeller, gifted with more than a touch of his father's showmanship, studied the man's face for a long time, then drawled, "Well, can you give me 24 hours to think it over?" By stalling, Rockefeller believed, he pinned down the deal on the most favorable terms. Aside from his reputation for exemplary character, especially among Baptist business executives, Rockefeller had several other traits that inspired passionate allegiance from bankers. He was a stickler for the truth in presenting facts, never fudged or equivocated in discussing problems, and promptly repaid loans. At numerous points in his early career, he was rescued by bankers from crises that might have capsized his business. At one bank, the directors balked at extending him further credit after he suffered a refinery fire and hadn't yet been compensated by insurers. Stepping into the breach, Director Stillman Witt asked the clerk to fetch his own strong box and announced with a flourish, "Here, gentlemen, these young men are all okay, and if they want to borrow more money, I want to see this bank advance it without hesitation. And if you want more security, here it is. Take what you want." It is impossible to comprehend Rockefeller's breathtaking ascent without realizing that he always moved into battle backed by abundant cash. Whether riding out downturns or coasting on booms, he kept plentiful reserves and won many bidding contests simply because his war chest was deeper. Rockefeller vividly described the way that he had hastily enlisted the aid of bankers to snap up one refinery. It required many hundreds of thousands of dollars, and in cash. Securities would not answer. "I received the message at about noon and had to get off on the 3 o'clock train. I drove from bank to bank, asking each president or cashier, whomever I could find first, to get ready for me all the funds he could possibly lay hands on. I told them I would be back to get the money later. I rounded up all of our banks in the city and made a second journey to get the money and kept going until I secured the necessary amount. With this, I was off on the 3 o'clock train and closed the transaction." To have orchestrated such a rapid campaign required a long relationship of trust with the banks. So adroitly did Rockefeller manage his unending quest for money that he became a director of a fire insurance company in 1866 and a director of the Ohio National Bank in 1868. By that point, he must have felt very sure of himself, even cocky, because he didn't bother to attend bank meetings and was ejected post-haste from one board. One is again impressed by the fantastic forward motion of his career, how quickly he evolved from humble supplicant to impatient businessman. Now in his late 20s, he had little time for fuddy-duddy directors and often dispensed with the niceties. As he said of the bank's board meetings, "I used to go at first, and there were some nice old gentlemen sitting stolidly about a table, discussing earnestly the problems offered by new departures in vault locks. It was all right in its way, but I was a busy man even then, and I really didn't have time for it. So they got rid of me speedily." For all his self-assurance, Rockefeller needed one associate who would share his daydreams, endorse his plans, and stiffen his resolve. And that indispensable alter ego was Henry Morrison Flagler. 9 years older than Rockefeller, with roguish good looks, Flagler was a dashing figure with luminous blue eyes, smooth black hair, and a handlebar mustache. "His clothes were of the most recent cut," an office messenger said admiringly. "He carried himself with a confidence that was regal. He had a heavy black mustache and the most beautiful hair I had ever seen." Funny and voluble, brisk and energetic, Flagler was nevertheless reticent about his motives and background, and in time surpassed his tight-lipped younger partner in fending off public inquiries. Flagler's upbringing had some noticeable parallels to Rockefeller's. Born in Hopewell, New York in 1830, the son of an impecunious Presbyterian pastor, he grew up in the Finger Lakes region of upstate New York before moving to Toledo, Ohio. In a previous marriage, his mother had been married to a Bellevue, Ohio doctor named David Harkness, who already had a son, Stephen, from his first marriage. They had a second son, Dan, before David Harkness died. Flagler's mother, Elizabeth, then married the Reverend Isaac Flagler. Evidently a man of courage and principle, Reverend Flagler created an uproar when he officiated over the marriage in Toledo of a young mulatto man to a white woman. Dropping out of school at 14, Henry made his way to Republic, Ohio, and worked in the small country store of Lamon Harkness, Dr. Harkness's younger brother. He later spun romantic tales of this first job, where he sold molasses and dry goods by day and slept in the drafty rear of the store at night. For special customers, Flagler would dip into a keg of brandy hidden upstairs. Becoming further entangled with his Harkness relatives, Henry married Lamon's daughter, the dark-eyed, demure Mary, in 1853. Before the Civil War, Henry earned good money in Lamon's grain business in Bellevue, in the corn and wheat belt of Sandusky County, where he shipped much produce through Cleveland. "John D. Rockefeller was a commission merchant in Cleveland, and I sent him a good many carloads of wheat, which he sold as my agent," he recalled. In a lucrative sideline, Flagler and his Harkness relatives took an interest in a whiskey distillery, which also provided an outlet for surplus grain. Like Rockefeller, Flagler was a prudish young man who never swore an oath stronger than thunder. As a teetotaler, Sunday school teacher, and minister's son, Flagler's liquor venture didn't square with his principles, though the profits evidently proved balm to his conscience. "I had scruples about the business and gave it up," he confided, "but not before I made $50,000 in Bellevue." Awash with cash, he built a stately Victorian mansion, the Gingerbread House, which was brightly illuminated with coal oil lamps. Among the visitors was John D. Rockefeller, then canvassing accounts for his partnership with Morris Clark. "He was a bright and active young fellow, full of vim and push," said Rockefeller, as if Flagler were the younger of the two. During the Civil War, Flagler, like Rockefeller, hired a substitute. His firm was a major contractor for grain purchases by the Union Army, and in 1862, brimful of wartime profits, he cast about for a fresh opportunity. At this point, Flagler stumbled into the sole business blunder of his career when he took a sizable stake in a salt company in Saginaw, Michigan, and moved his family there. When the war ended, slashing demand for salt, his firm went bankrupt, the victim of a classic boom and bust cycle. Losing everything, he had to be bailed out by a giant loan from the Harkness family. "At the end of 3 years, I had lost my little fortune and owed $50,000 to about 50,000 Irishmen who had been working in the salt factory," said Flagler. He had much occasion to ponder the contradictions of a market economy in which dynamic industries swiftly expand during prosperity, only to find themselves overextended during downturns. To cope with excess production, many Saginaw salt companies opted for cooperation over competition and joined a cartel arrangement to try to prop up salt prices, providing a precedent for Standard Oil. After his sobering reversal of fortune, Flagler entered a despondent period in which he sometimes skipped lunch to save money. Returning to Bellevue, he tried to market felt wool as well as a machine he had invented that would supposedly produce a perfect horseshoe. Deciding to try his luck in Cleveland, where Stephen V. Harkness had moved in 1866, he took a job selling grain with Rockefeller's ex-partner, Morris Clark, and by coincidence filled the post recently vacated by Rockefeller. Perhaps to tweak Clark, Rockefeller invited Flagler to rent desk space in his office suite in the Sexton Block. As Flagler prospered, he settled his debts, bought a fine house on Euclid Avenue, and joined the First Presbyterian Church. As they strolled to and from work together, Flagler and Rockefeller must have soon discovered their remarkable affinity as businessmen. Chafing at his dependence on loans and wondering when he might deplete the capital of local banks, Rockefeller now scouted out large individual investors and was probably acutely aware of the wealth of Flagler's relatives. Through Flagler's introduction, Rockefeller solicited money from Stephen V. Harkness, by now one of Cleveland's richest men. A bearish man with thick, slightly unkempt hair, fluffy sideburns, and a walrus mustache, Harkness had capitalized on inside political information to make a fortune during the war. As an ally of U.S. Senator John Sherman of Ohio, he had received timely word in 1862 of an upcoming government move to levy a $2 tax on every gallon of malt and distilled liquor. Before the tax took effect, he busily stockpiled wine and whiskey, and even raided the deposits of a local bank he owned to pour more money into this operation. When the tax was enacted in July 1862, he sold his enormous cache of spirits for a fast $300,000 profit. It is deeply ironic that Rockefeller, a staunch temperance advocate, got one of his most significant cash infusions from questionable gains in liquor. While Rockefeller was negotiating a large loan from Stephen V. Harkness during an hour-long talk in 1867, the latter saw an excellent opportunity to set up Henry in business, and instead of extending a loan, asked for a large block of stock in the company. Investing $100,000, a third of the new firm's capital, Harkness made it a precondition of his investment that Henry become treasurer and his personal deputy in the firm. As Harkness said to Rockefeller, "Young man, you can have all the money you want. You are on the right track, and I am with you." As to Henry's part, he added, "I'll make Henry my watchdog." Since Harkness was also a director of banks, railroads, mining, real estate, and manufacturing companies, the tie ushered Rockefeller into a new universe of business connections. On March 4, 1867, the Cleveland Leader announced the formation of a new partnership, Rockefeller, Andrews, and Flagler, with offices in the Case Building, a solid masonry structure with rounded Romanesque windows and a prestigious address on the public square. "This firm is one of the oldest in the refining business, and their trade already a mammoth one. Their establishment is one of the largest in the United States. Among the many oil refining enterprises, this seems to be one of the most successful. Its heavy capital and consummate management have kept it clear of the many shoals upon which oil refining houses have so often been stranded." From reading this description, one would have thought the firm was run by gray reverend men, whereas Rockefeller, the boy wonder of Cleveland business, was just 27. Starting with Flagler's recruitment, Rockefeller began to assemble the team of capable, congenial executives who would transform the Cleveland refiner into the world's strongest industrial company. Both Rockefeller and Flagler had nimble minds for numbers and infinite dexterity with balance sheets. Neither was interested in a modest success, and they were both prepared to go as far and as fast as the marketplace allowed. As Flagler boasted, "I've always been contented, but I've never been satisfied." Rockefeller found his partner's enthusiasm a tonic, noting that Flagler was always on the active side of every question, and to his wonderful energy is due much of the rapid progress of the company in the early days. Given their exalted goals, it probably helped that Flagler had been chastened by failure and was acquainted with the perils of complacency. Rockefeller loved Flagler's dictum that a friendship founded on business was superior to a business founded on friendship. And for several decades they worked together in an almost seamless fashion. In the early years the two men were bound by a common dream, lived near each other, and seemed virtually inseparable. As Rockefeller said in his memoirs, "We met and walked to the office together, walked home to luncheon, back again after luncheon, and home again at night. On these walks, when we were away from the office interruptions, we did our thinking, talking, and planning together." For a man as reserved as Rockefeller, this picture suggests an unbuttoned exchange of ideas of a sort he permitted with few people. In the office, their intimacy was patent to visitors, for they had back-to-back desks and shared many duties. They even developed a collective letter-writing style, passing drafts back and forth with each making minor improvements until they expressed what was wanted, but not one syllable more. At this point, the letters were ready to be vetted by the severest judge, Mrs. Rockefeller, who was, said one office worker, known to be the most valued advisor. Endowed with considerable verbal skill, Flagler had such a gift for drawing up legal documents, or sniffing out hidden pitfalls in contracts, that Rockefeller insisted he could have taught the fine points of contract law to lawyers. No small edge for a firm that would be engaged in running legal battles. In his later years, Flagler developed into a grandee of such rich tastes that it is instructive to note his austere early style. Not only did he labor 6 days a week, but he shunned bars and theaters as the devil's playgrounds and became superintendent of the First Presbyterian Church. Like Rockefeller, he advocated self-discipline and deferred gratification. As he said of his first threadbare days in Cleveland, "I wore a thin overcoat and thought how comfortable I should be when I could afford a long, thick ulster. I carried a lunch in my pocket until I was a rich man. I trained myself in the school of self-control and self-denial. It was hard on me, but I would rather be my own tyrant than have someone else tyrannize me." After his wife, Mary, gave birth to a son, Henry Harkness Flagler, in 1870, she never regained her health and turned into an invalid. For the next 17 years, Flagler stayed home at night so he could read to her for hours on end, with John and Laura Rockefeller often stopping by to mitigate the gloom. That Flagler was his most valuable partner was always unquestioned dogma for Rockefeller. Yet one wonders whether the influence was altogether benign. An ebullient man, Flagler wouldn't stop to quibble over legal niceties when taken by a powerful idea. And even Rockefeller hinted obliquely at the dangers posed by Flagler's headstrong nature. "He was a man of great force and determination," said Rockefeller, "though perhaps he needed a restraining influence at times when his enthusiasm was roused." On his desk, Flagler kept a quote from a popular novel, David Harum, which said, "Do unto others as they would do unto you, and do it first." What makes Flagler's ethics consequential for Rockefeller's career was that he was the mastermind of many negotiations with the railroads, the single most controversial aspect of Standard Oil history. It's not clear that anyone could have tempered the fiercely irrepressible drive of John D. Rockefeller, but the swashbuckling Flagler had especially little interest in transposing the lessons of his Sunday school classes to the profane, turbulent world of oil refining. As far as Rockefeller was concerned, however, Flagler's arrival was providential, for the oil industry was about to be thrown into unprecedented turmoil, making relations with the railroads all important. Transportation assumed a pivotal place in the petroleum business for an elementary reason. Drake had discovered oil in a distant, inaccessible spot that was, at first, poorly served by the railroads. For several years, teamsters, the wagoners who hauled out the barrels, exercised a brutal tyranny and charged exorbitant sums. Since oil was a relatively cheap, standardized commodity, transportation costs inevitably figured as a critical factor in the competitive struggle. The logical and elegant solution, to construct a comprehensive pipeline network, encountered harsh resistance from the threatened Teamsters. During the 1865 pit hole frenzy, Samuel Van Sickle laid a 2-inch iron pipeline from Oil Creek to railroad tracks 6 miles away. Defying armed guards, roaming gangs of Teamsters descended each night and tore up sections of the pipeline. When Henry Harley launched a second pipeline, they again dug up pipes and set storage tanks ablaze, forcing Harley to field a small army of Pinkerton detectives to squash the revolt. The Teamsters must have known they were fighting a rearguard action, but for a time they managed to delay the installation of a pipeline system. Between the benighted rule of the Teamsters and the future domination by efficient pipelines, there arose an interregnum in which the railroads exercised pervasive influence over everything that happened in the industry. At first they tried to ship barrels on open flat cars, but the swaying, jolting ride splintered the containers and spilled their contents. After the Civil War, this hazardous method was superseded by primitive tank cars, twin pine tubs mounted on flat cars, that were soon replaced in turn by single iron tanks that became the industry norm. Such technical advances allowed the railroads to speed oil across the continent and vastly expanded the market for petroleum products. During the first few years, the oil business was so effortlessly profitable that refineries sprang up in 6 competing centers. The inland centers, the oil regions Pittsburgh and Cleveland, and the seaboard centers, New York, Philadelphia, and Baltimore, engaged in pitched battles to control the business. Favored by proximity to the wells, the western Pennsylvania refiners seemed to possess an incalculable edge. But they had to import chemicals, barrels, machinery, and labor, and therefore labored under distinct handicaps. Nonetheless, these refiners saved so much on transportation that they fancied they would emerge supreme in the oil business. Later, Rockefeller admitted that he'd been tempted to switch operations to Pennsylvania, yet he and his partners didn't wish to uproot their families or write off their considerable investment in Cleveland. They also feared that the glory of the oil regions might soon fade into history, as Rockefeller later noted in a statement reminiscent of Percy Bysshe Shelley's poem Ozymandias. "You have seen Pithole and Petroleum Center, the places where once stood big prosperous cities, in which men made millions of dollars out of oil. Now they are bits of wilderness, overgrown with weeds, and with nothing left to tell of their greatness but a few scattered parts of old houses and the memory of a few aged men. Prudent men did not want to place all their capital into business in such places." Even late in life, Rockefeller was loath to confess, for political reasons, the overriding reason for his attachment to Cleveland. It was the hub of so many transportation networks that he had tremendous room to maneuver in freight negotiations. During the summer months, he could send oil by water, greatly enhancing his bargaining power with the railroads. His firm could load their oil in the season of lake navigation and canal navigation upon vessels at Cleveland and from Buffalo by the Erie Canal, and could deliver the oil to their warehouses in New York at a cost lower than the current rates at which the railway companies had been seeking the business. Armed with this potent weapon, Rockefeller obtained such excellent railroad rates that it compensated for having to ship the crude oil to Cleveland before sending refined oil to the Atlantic coast, a far more circuitous route than shipping from Titusville straight to New York. Fed by rail links to Chicago, St. Louis, and Cincinnati, Cleveland also served as a natural gateway to Western markets. Other Cleveland refiners evidently made the same calculation, and by late 1866, the city supported 50 refineries, ranking second only to Pittsburgh. Cleveland's refineries were so numerous that their foul, acrid atmosphere enveloped the outskirts, tainting the beer from local breweries and souring the milk. Besides access to the Erie Canal and Lake Erie, Cleveland was serviced by 3 main railroad lines that gave its inland refineries direct access to eastern ports: the New York Central, which ran north from New York City to Albany and then west to Buffalo, where its lakeshore line ran along Lake Erie to Cleveland; the Erie Railroad, which also sped across New York State, to a point south of Buffalo where its Atlantic and Great Western subsidiary headed down into Cleveland and the oil regions, and the August Pennsylvania Railroad, which went from New York and Philadelphia to Harrisburg and Pittsburgh. With virtuosic brilliance, Rockefeller and Flagler played these three railroads against each other in seemingly endless permutations. They even managed to manipulate such redoubtable figures as the notorious Jay Gould, who had wrested the Erie Railroad from Commodore Vanderbilt in 1868. Flagler singled out Gould as the fairest and squarest of the railroad chieftains in his dealings, and Rockefeller, when asked to name the greatest businessman he had ever met, instantly cited Gould. Gould himself later asserted that John D. Rockefeller had possessed the highest genius for constructive organization in American economic history. Before long, the various oil refining centers were rushing to form tactical alliances with these railroad networks. As a natural outgrowth of their route structure, the New York Central and the Erie wanted to promote Cleveland as a refining center and regarded Rockefeller as a critical ally in efforts to boost their oil freight business. With easy access to the oil fields via the Allegheny River, Pittsburgh might have seemed the optimal location, but its refiners were always held hostage to the freight monopoly of the Pennsylvania Railroad. Following a myopic and ultimately destructive policy toward Pittsburgh, the Pennsylvania Railroad decided it was more profitable to carry crude oil from Oil Creek all the way to Philadelphia or New York refineries, rather than to have it refined in Pittsburgh. By penalizing Pittsburgh refiners with crushing rates, the railroad fattened its short-term profits but sacrificed the city's future as a refining center and paved the way for the hegemony of the city the Pennsylvania wanted most to eradicate, Cleveland. As Rockefeller later said, the Pennsylvania Railroad's attitude made it easy for him to find common cause with its arch rivals, and he forged a cabal with the New York Central and the Erie that the Pennsylvania was hard-pressed to stop. By the late 1860s, the press was rife with reports that the Pennsylvania Railroad had decreed that Cleveland would be wiped out as a refining center as with a sponge, a statement forever engraved on Rockefeller's unforgiving memory. Taking this as a declaration of war, he was emboldened to respond with the most robust countermeasures at his command. He was a man who always acted on Flagler's business motto of favoring sharp, vigorous, and decisive measures. The Pennsylvania statement set off a panic-stricken reaction in Cleveland as local refiners prepared to transfer their operations to Oil Creek. Cool-headed in the face of such hysteria, Rockefeller saw that he could convert this chaos to advantage. By threatening to strip the others of their oil traffic, the Pennsylvania had placed the Erie and New York Central in a vulnerable position, and Rockefeller and Flagler decided to use this leverage to wring extreme concessions from them. In the spring of 1868, Jay Gould hatched a secret deal with Rockefeller and Flagler that gave them shares in a subsidiary company called the Allegheny Transportation Company, which was the first major pipeline network serving Oil Creek. Through this deal, the Cleveland refiners received a staggering 75% rebate on oil shipped through the Erie system. As part of this extraordinary bonanza, Flagler also cut a deal with the Atlantic and Great Western, an Erie subsidiary, that gave Rockefeller, Andrews, and Flagler highly advantageous rates on rail shipments between Cleveland and the oil regions. In this season of bountiful concessions, Flagler also approached General J.H. Devereux, the newly installed vice president of the Lake Shore Railroad, which formed part of the New York Central system. Trained as a civil engineer, Devereux had revamped the railroad system in Northern Virginia to assist the Union Army and was commended by Lincoln for his work. In negotiating a new framework with him, Rockefeller and Flagler argued for preferential rates that would more than match discounts extended by the Pennsylvania Railroad to its customers in the oil regions. In other words, the young Cleveland refiners cannily converted their geographic disadvantage into a powerful bargaining tool and secured covert rates that allowed them to ship crude oil to Cleveland and then refined oil to New York for only $1.65 per barrel, compared to an officially listed rate of $2.40 per barrel. In exchange for this extraordinary concession, Rockefeller and Flagler didn't simply try to squeeze the railroads, they were much too shrewd and subtle for that, but offered compelling incentives. For instance, they agreed to assume legal liability for fire or other accidents and stop using water transport during the summer months. The biggest plum they dangled before Devereux was a promise to supply the lakeshore with an astonishing 60 carloads of refined oil daily. Since Rockefeller lacked the refining capacity to fulfill this ambitious pledge, he was evidently prepared to coordinate shipments with other Cleveland refiners. For any railroad, the prospect of steady shipments was irresistible, for they could dispatch trains composed solely of oil tank cars instead of a motley assortment of freight cars picking up different products at different places. By consolidating many small shippers into one big shipper making regular uniform shipments in massive quantities, the railroads could reduce the average round-trip time of their trains to New York from 30 days to 10 and operate a fleet of 600 cars instead of 1,800. Never shy about his accomplishments, Rockefeller knew that he had broached a revolutionary deal. It was a large, regular volume of business, such as had not hitherto been given to the roads in question. From that moment, the railroads acquired a vested interest in the creation of a gigantic oil monopoly that would lower their costs, boost their profits, and generally simplify their lives. As in other industries, the railroads developed a stake in the growth of big businesses whose economies of scale permitted them to operate more efficiently, an ominous fact for small, struggling refiners who were gradually weeded out in the savage competitive strife. Without doubt, the Lakeshore deal marked a turning point for Rockefeller, the oil industry, and the entire American economy. Decades later, Ida Tarbell condemned it as Rockefeller's original sin from which all others sprang. Mr. Rockefeller certainly saw by 1868 that he had no legitimate superiority over those competing with him in Cleveland, which would ever enable him to be anything more than one of the big men in his line. Only Rockefeller's willingness to cheat and cut corners, Tarbell contended, had enabled him to outdistance the pack. This claim, echoed by Rockefeller's most virulent critics, overstates the case. For even before Rockefeller accepted his first rebate, he was the world's largest refiner, equal in size to the next three largest Cleveland refineries combined. In fact, it was the unparalleled scope of his operation that had enabled him to cut this exceptional deal in the first place. Tarbell perceived correctly, however, that the principal advantage of Rockefeller's commanding position was that it meant special power to compel railroad freight concessions. In closing their historic deal, Rockefeller and Flagler suffered no twinges of conscience and were frankly elated by their triumph. "I remember when the Standard received its first rebate," said Flagler. "I went home in great delight. I had won a great victory, I thought." But they knew they had dabbled in a dark and controversial practice, for the rebates were predicated on great secrecy. Many years later, Rockefeller explained to one railroad negotiator that their dealings with the Lakeshore rested on oral agreements that were never committed to paper. "Our people do not think it would be best for the Lakeshore Road or us to have a contract, but with the good faith between us and desire to promote each other's interests, we can serve each other better by being able to say we have no contracts." Because many railroad deals ended with a handshake, not a signature, Rockefeller could breezily deny their existence without fear of embarrassing refutations later on. As the chief transportation dealmaker, Flagler had overseen the landmark pact, and Rockefeller always credited him for it. Some of this derived from Rockefeller's humility, but it also betrayed a lifelong habit of covering his tracks and pretending to be elsewhere when critical decisions were made. Although Rockefeller didn't lead the Lakeshore negotiations, he was smack in the thick of them. On August 19, 1868, he sent a fascinating letter to Setti from New York that shows his toughness vis-à-vis the Vanderbilts, who controlled the New York Central, the Lakeshore's parent. "We were sent for by Mr. Vanderbilt yesterday at 12 o'clock and did not go. He is anxious to get our business and said he could meet us on the terms. We sent our card by the messenger that Vanderbilt might know where to find our office later." The point is worth underscoring. 29-year-old John D. Rockefeller demanded that 74-year-old Commodore Vanderbilt, the emperor of the railroad world, come to him. This refusal to truckle, bend, or bow to others, this insistence on dealing with other people on his own terms, time, and turf, distinguished Rockefeller throughout his career. Bolstered by the Lakeshore deal, Cleveland soon surpassed Pittsburgh as the leading refining center, and for the first time, journalists began to track Rockefeller's ascendancy. In 1869, one writer marveled at the power that this laconic young man, in his understated manner, had already attained in Cleveland. "He occupies a position in our business circles second to but few. Close application to one kind of business, an avoidance of all positions of honorary character that cost time, keeping everything pertaining to his business in so methodical a manner that he knows every night how he stands with the world." Today, an arcane forgotten subject, the issue of railroad rebates generated heated debate in post-Civil War America, since they directly affected the shape of the economy and the distribution of wealth. Railroads had obtained the power to produce either a concentrated economy with progressively larger business units, or to perpetuate the small-scale economy of antebellum America. The proliferation of rebates hastened the shift toward an integrated national economy, top-heavy with giant companies enjoying preferential freight rates. Rockefeller justly argued that he hadn't invented the rebate and that the Pennsylvania Railroad had granted thousands of them in the 6 years before his seminal Lakeshore deal. It was a common practice in all descriptions of freighting, not peculiar to oil, in merchandise, grain, everything. Rebates had inevitably accompanied railroad expansion. As the total railroad trackage doubled to 70,000 miles within 8 years after the Civil War, the roads were saddled with high fixed costs and heavy bonded debt. This forced them to maintain a high, steady freight volume to stay alive, and waylaid them into vicious rate wars. Rebates weren't just solicited by shippers, but were sedulously pushed by railway freight agents eager to win over new business. Rebates enabled them to maintain the fiction of listed rates while secretly giving discounts to favored shippers. Over time, relations grew ever closer and more incestuous between the railroads and large shippers. For decades, Rockefeller and his colleagues enjoyed free passes on all major railroads, which they regarded not as payoffs, but as natural perquisites of their business. Rockefeller never saw rebates as criminal or illegitimate or as favors secured only by bullying monopolies. He was correct in stating that listed rates were always a farce, a starting point for haggling. Many refiners received rebates, not just the leading firms, and some tiny rivals actually got superior discounts, especially from the Pennsylvania Railroad. Rockefeller's business papers display much internal grumbling about this presumed inequity, for which he and his colleagues regularly chastised railroad officials at critical moments in negotiations. But in spite of numerous scattered cases of rival refiners getting comparable rebates, no other firm received so many rebates so consistently over so many years or on such a colossal scale as Rockefeller's. It was therefore disingenuous of him to suggest that rebates played only an incidental role in his success. So were Ida Tarbell and other detractors justified in tarring Rockefeller's whole career based on railroad rebates? Unfortunately, the controversy was played out in a gray area of ethics and the law that makes a definitive answer impossible. From a strictly economic standpoint, Rockefeller rested on solid ground when he insisted that bulk shippers deserved a discount. Who can buy beef the cheapest? The housewife for her family, the steward for a club or hotel, or the commissary for an army? Who is entitled to better rebates from a railroad? Those who give it 5,000 barrels a day, or those who give 500 barrels, or 50 barrels? Besides providing a steady flow of oil shipments, Rockefeller's firm invested heavily in warehouses, terminals, loading platforms, and other railroad facilities, so that the roads probably derived more profit from his shipments than from those of rivals who paid higher rates. Small, irregular shippers were the bane of railroads for the simple mechanical reason that they forced the trains to stop repeatedly to pick up single carloads of oil. To meet the terms of his deal with the lakeshore, Rockefeller had to run his refineries at full capacity, even when kerosene demand slackened. He therefore paid a price for his rebates and felt that equal rates for all shippers would have unfairly penalized his firm. Perhaps because Ida Tarbell trained a glaring spotlight on the rebate issue, Rockefeller insisted vehemently in later interviews that the real profitability of his firm lay elsewhere. In an intriguing aside in later years, he even hinted that the clamor over rebates conveniently deflected public attention away from other, more profitable aspects of his operation. Along this line, much was said about rebates and drawbacks for long years, and the Standard Oil Company knew full well that the public were not on the right scent. They knew where their profits came from, but they did not deem it wise to inform the public, and especially their competitors, of the real secret sources of their strength. Indeed, one can argue that the obsession among reformers with the rebate issue might have blinded them to a multitude of other sins. Not until the Interstate Commerce Act in 1887 did it become an illegal, punishable offense for railroads to give rebates, and the practice didn't cease entirely until the 1903 Elkins Act. Nevertheless, by the end of the Civil War, a widespread belief had begun to take hold that railroads were common carriers and should shun favoritism. Ida Tarbell cited provisions in the Pennsylvania State Constitution that, as she interpreted them, compelled railroads to serve as common carriers and avoid discrimination. Yet in the last analysis, she based her withering critique of Rockefeller less on specific laws than on her belief that he had violated a sense of fair play. That is, she wrote in McClure's magazine in July 1905, rebate giving then as now was regarded as one of those lower business practices which characterizes commerce at all periods, and against which men of honor struggle and of which men of greed take advantage. In the privacy of his study in 1917, an unrepentant Rockefeller disputed her view of the prevailing business ethics. I deny that it was regarded as a dishonorable practice for a merchant or manufacturer to obtain the best rates possible for his goods. As to Tarbell's charge that the secrecy of rebates proved their immorality, Rockefeller countered that railroads didn't wish to advertise discounts that might then be demanded by other shippers. For these arrangements were not, except by the academic, expected to be published any more than the general of an army's plans are published to enable the enemy to defeat him. The most compelling argument against rebates was that railroads received state charters and therefore had the right of eminent domain, that is, the right to claim private property in order to lay down tracks, investing their activities with a public character. In 1867, a committee of the Ohio Senate declared that railroads, as common carriers, should charge equal rates, but a bill incorporating these ideas was defeated. The following year, just as Rockefeller implemented his Lakeshore deal, a Pennsylvania Senate committee reported that railroads were common carriers and had no right to show partiality among their customers. But again, no regulatory changes ensued. Almost 20 years passed before reformers succeeded in introducing public regulation that forced an end to the railroad favoritism that so incensed farmers and other small shippers across America. In the meantime, Rockefeller profited enormously from the failure of public authorities to rectify the iniquities of the transportation system, and his firm understandably kept up vigorous lobbying efforts to perpetuate the status quo. Chapter 7. Millionaire's Row. Rockefeller had speedily acquired a level of respectability that would have seemed unthinkable 15 years before, when he and his demoralized family were crowded into the Humiston House in Strongsville. In August 1868, after his rebate deal with the Lakeshore Railroad, he certified his enhanced status in Cleveland, when he and Setti moved from Cheshire Street to a solid brick home at 424 Euclid Avenue. This move dramatized the immense distance he had traveled after a few years in the oil business. Local boosters had already tagged Euclid Avenue the most beautiful street in the world, with homes that lavishly mirrored the local fortunes in oil, iron, banking, timber, railroads, and real estate. All of the town's new opulence was reflected in this street of massive houses. The residential address for such local luminaries as Henry B. Payne, Amasa Stone, and John Hay, Euclid Avenue claimed so many mansions that it had richly earned its sobriquet of Millionaire's Row. With the spacious grandeur of a fine Victorian street, always busy with fashionable horses and carriages, the wide avenue had a double row of elms that created a tall, shady canopy overhead. The imposing homes were deeply recessed from the street, their trimmed lawns and shapely shrubbery providing buffer zones between the houses and their distant front gates. Since few houses were separated from adjoining houses by fences, the street sometimes gave the impression of being a single flowing park, with elegant homes standing in an unbroken expanse of greenery. While Rockefeller's home looked small and cramped beside Amasa Stone's towering manse and other gaudy monstrosities, it was a substantial two-story structure with a mansard roof, a portico, and arched windows, shielded from the street by an iron picket fence that spanned its entire 116-foot frontage. Rockefeller could have afforded something showier than this $40,000 house, and pedestrians might have thought its owner a lesser light in business. Yet this was exactly the misimpression that he wanted to convey. Far from trying to parade his wealth, he wanted to blend into the scenery. Even at home, Rockefeller was discreet and behaved as if he was concealing some secret from prying eyes. Beyond that, he had the Puritan's discomfort with possessions, a nagging Baptist anxiety that decoration might appear idolatrous. Again, like Weber's ideal capitalist, he avoids ostentation and unnecessary expenditure, as well as conscious enjoyment of his power, and is embarrassed by the outward signs of the social recognition which he receives. Fond of roomy, ungainly houses that he could remodel ceaselessly, Rockefeller would have been stymied by a house that required no improvement. Utilitarian by nature, he was more concerned with the grounds and interiors of homes than with the subtleties of architectural ornamentation. "I hate frills," he once said. "Useful things, beautiful things are admirable, but frills, affectations, mere pretenses of being something very fine, bore me very much." With a country boy's love of open spaces, he hated anything confined or cluttered, and probably chose the Euclid Avenue house for its large, high-ceilinged rooms, which included a parlor, a sitting room, and a dining room downstairs, plus four bedrooms upstairs. Rockefeller devoted more time and expense to the trees and shrubbery than to the house itself. To expand his gardens, he bought an adjoining lot but was disturbed by the house that came with it and obstructed his view. Since he detested waste, he donated the house to a new girls' school being built a block away. In what was hailed as an engineering wonder at the time, the brick house was jacked up by a windlass and rolled down the block on greased logs, a spectacle that was covered by local papers and drew spectators. "Mr. Rockefeller set the house on new foundations where it was as good as ever," Lucy Spellman said of her brother-in-law's feat. This was a marvelous undertaking, but then he was always undertaking marvelous things. Behind the house he built a stone stable and coach house more magnificent than the residence itself. Over 100 feet long, it had stout beams, pine panels, and elaborate chandeliers. An expert driver with either a pair of horses or a four in hand, Rockefeller had a passion for trotters, and Euclid Avenue provided a perfect straightaway for races. If anybody tried to pass him, the hyper-competitive Rockefeller automatically turned it into a trial of speed. John, William, and Frank were stockholders in a racing club called the Cleveland Driving Park Company, the first amateur club of its sort in America. Unable to do anything in a casual manner, Rockefeller became obsessive about his hobbies, which he could sometimes indulge in extravagant fashion. In the 1870s, his records show, he paid stupendous sums, from $10,000 to $12,500, for thoroughbred trotters with such evocative names as Midnight, Flash, Jesse, Baron, and Trifle. In his early days in business, Rockefeller often suffered from severe neck pains that might have indicated stress on the job, and he turned to horses as a therapeutic diversion. "I would leave my office in the afternoon and drive a pair of fast horses as hard as they could go. Trot, brake, gallop, everything." Since Seti was also fond of horses, they often rode together. His style of racing was also revealing. He never applied cruel, coercive measures to recalcitrant horses, but studied them closely and tried to coax them along gently and with great patience. "I remember when my brother William and I used to go riding," he said. "I would invariably come in first. He would be covered with perspiration, as was his horse. My horse would be too, but I would be as cool as I am now. I always would talk to my horses, quietly, steadily, never get excited." This unflappable style and conservation of energy also characterized his approach to the management of his vast oil empire. Unlike his philandering father, John D. Rockefeller remained firmly, almost prudishly anchored in domestic life. Much like Jay Gould, who didn't drink, smoke, or gallivant with women, Rockefeller's harsh business tactics were counterbalanced by exemplary behavior at home, where he was a sweet, respectful Victorian husband. To borrow a line from Flaubert, to be fiercely revolutionary in business, he needed to be utterly conventional at home. Eternally at war with the devil, John and Seti allowed their religious beliefs to define their entire cultural agenda. They subscribed to seats at the Philharmonic, for instance, but theater and opera were too racy for these professing Christians. Shying away from social situations that weren't safely predictable, they socialized only within a small circle of family members, business associates, and church friends, and never went to clubs or dinner parties. "Club life did not appeal to me," said Rockefeller. "I was meeting all the people I needed to meet in my day's work. My family would rather have me at home, even if I were snoring in an easy chair, than going out for the evening, and certainly I preferred to stay at home." He especially enjoyed the company of ministers, whose genial homiletic style matched his own. Thus walled off from temptation, Rockefeller was virtually untouched by the decadence of the Gilded Age. Much of Rockefeller's preference for home life stemmed from his strict temperance views. Even late in life, he accepted an invitation to a hotel barbecue, then went to investigate the site beforehand. When he spotted empty beer bottles on the premises, he promptly withdrew his acceptance. Since he and Seti were deeply involved in temperance work, they did everything from sponsoring lecture tours to lobbying to have temperance principles inserted in school textbooks. They avoided the very presence of liquor, and thus severely cramped their social activities. Yet within their circumscribed world, they had a happy home life. Rockefeller bridled at the notion that he was a business-obsessed drudge, a slave to the office. "I know of nothing more despicable and pathetic than a man who devotes all the waking hours of the day to making money for money's sake," he recorded in his memoirs. He worked at a more leisurely pace than many other executives, napping daily after lunch and often dozing in a lounge chair after dinner. To explain his extraordinary longevity, he later said, doubtless overstating the matter, "I'm here because I shirked, did less work, lived more in the open air, enjoyed the open air, sunshine, and exercise." By his mid-30s, he had installed a telegraph wire between home and office so that he could spend 3 or 4 afternoons each week at home, planting trees, gardening, and enjoying the sunshine. Rockefeller didn't do this in a purely recreational spirit, but mingled work and rest to pace himself and improve his productivity. In time, he became something of an evangelist on health-related issues. "It is remarkable how much we all could do if we avoid hustling and go along at an even pace and keep from attempting too much." There was a clockwork regularity about Rockefeller's life that made it seem mechanical to outsiders, but that he found soothing. He didn't seem to require time to indulge normal human idleness, much less illicit passion. In his rigidly compartmentalized life, each hour was tightly budgeted, whether for business, religion, family, or exercise. Perhaps these daily rituals helped him to deal with underlying tensions that might otherwise have become ungovernable. For although he tried to project an air of unhurried calm, he was under terrific strain in creating his oil empire. He fretted endlessly about his company, and below the surface was constantly on edge. In one of his few admissions of weakness, he recalled that, "For years on end I never had a solid night's sleep, worrying about how it was to come out. I tossed about in bed night after night, worrying over the outcome. All the fortune that I have made has not served to compensate for the anxiety of that period." By the time they moved to Euclid Avenue, the Rockefellers already had one child, Elizabeth, always called Bessie, who was born in the Cheshire Street house in 1866. When Setti was confined during childbirth and couldn't attend church, John jotted down notes on the sermon and read them back to her afterward. All of the remaining children were born in an upstairs bedroom at Euclid Avenue. Their second child, Alice, was born in July 1869, but died a year later. Then came Alta, 1871, Edith, 1872, and John Jr., 1874. They were delivered by a pioneering physician, Dr. Myra Herrick, Cleveland's first woman doctor, who organized a short-lived homeopathic college to train women in the field. When she set up a free medical dispensary staffed exclusively by female doctors to assist low-income women, Setti and Mary Flagler were prominent contributors. A surprisingly flexible, egalitarian father, Rockefeller never shrank from child care. His sister-in-law, Lute, who gave up teaching and went to live with them, told how John eased the burden from Setti's shoulders when he was at home. He would get up from his nap the moment he heard a baby cry and carry the little one up and down the room until she was quieted. Rockefeller was always patient with his children and seldom lost his temper or uttered a harsh word. As the son of a self-absorbed absentee father, he made a point of being an affectionate parent and something of a homebody. Like Big Bill, however, Rockefeller could be a sprightly companion for his children. He would get down on all fours and bear them on his back, recapturing a boyish glee that was seldom evident at the office. When they played blind man's buff, he electrified them with daring feints, sudden thrusts, and unexpected wheeling turns, followed by whoops of delight when he won. Attuned to their fantasy world, he liked to gather the children around him and tell fairy tales. Also like his father, he had an inexhaustible supply of stunts. At dinner, he dazzled the children by balancing fine china plates on the tip of his nose. He also balanced crackers on his nose, then gave them a sudden flip and caught them in his mouth. He taught the children to swim, row, skate, and ride, and he had a talent for devising imaginative outings. On moonlit nights at Forest Hill, the Cleveland estate Rockefeller bought in the 1870s, they ventured forth on bicycle trips, with Rockefeller pinning a large white handkerchief to the back of his coat and leading the children through winding, mysterious forest roads. John Jr. never forgot skating with his father. "The lake was deep, so we took under each arm long, narrow boards, which would hold us up in case we broke through the ice." That was characteristic of father. He always took the utmost care to examine any project thoroughly. Then, when convinced it was safe, put it through without further question. Perhaps to create a substitute for theater and other entertainments proscribed by their religion, John and Setti encouraged the children's musical talents, and each one took up an instrument. They formed their own quartet, with Bessie on violin, Alta on piano, Edith on cello, and John Jr. on violin, so that the house echoed with the works of Mozart, Beethoven, and Handel. The children approached music as serious art, not frivolous amusement, and performed frequently at church events. They weren't barred from playing contemporary popular music. If there was more merriment in Rockefeller's household than we might have suspected, there was also an underlying sobriety. His children remembered the playful moments, but outsiders were struck by the somber, stuffy atmosphere and found something almost spooky about the Rockefeller home, with one disgruntled tutor leaving this ghastly description: "The elastic step, the laughter of youth, the lightheartedness, the romping about, the playfulness which one is supposed to meet among the young and happy, were entirely lacking, lacking almost to dejection. It was a gloomy horizon with a heaviness that pervaded the entire household. Silence and gloom everywhere." Rockefeller kept his children hermetically cut off from the world, and hired governesses to educate them at home. Aside from church, They never engaged in outside social or civic functions, and betrayed a very Baptist fear of worldly entertainments. In the summertime, the children's friends might come to visit for a week or two at a time, but never the reverse. And even these playmates were the cautiously screened offspring of John and Setti's church companions. As John Jr. remembered, "Our interests centered in the house. Our friends came there almost wholly. We went rarely, practically none at all, to neighbors' houses." John Jr. hinted that the children brought to visit weren't real companions and were mostly window dressing to gratify his parents. "We had no childhood friends, no school friends." It was a far cry from Thorsten Veblen's image of the spoiled leisure class. Convinced that struggle was the crucible of character, Rockefeller faced a delicate task in raising his children. He wanted to accumulate wealth while inculcating in them the values of his threadbare boyhood. The first step in saving them from extravagance was keeping them ignorant of their father's affluence. Until they were adults, Rockefeller's children never visited his office or refineries, and even then they were accompanied by company officials, never father. At home, Rockefeller created a make-believe market economy, calling Setti the general manager and requiring the children to keep careful account books. They earned pocket money by performing chores and received 2 cents for killing flies, 10 cents for sharpening pencils, 5 cents per hour for practicing their musical instruments, and $1 for repairing vases. They were given 2 cents per day for abstaining from candy and a dime bonus for each consecutive day of abstinence. Each toiled in a separate patch of the vegetable garden, earning a penny for every 10 weeds they pulled up. John Jr. got 15 cents an hour for chopping wood and 10 cents per day for superintending paths. Rockefeller took pride in training his children as miniature household workers. Years later, riding on a train with his 13-year-old daughter, he told a traveling companion, "This little girl is earning money already. You never could imagine how she does it. I have learned what my gas bills should average when the gas is managed with care. And I have told her that she can have for pin money all that she will save every month on this amount, so she goes around every night and keeps the gas turned down where it is not needed." Rockefeller never tired of preaching economy, and whenever a package arrived at home, he made a point of saving the paper and string. Setti was equally vigilant. When the children clamored for bicycles, John suggested buying one for each child. "No," said Setti, "we will buy just one for all of them." "But, my dear," John protested, "tricycles do not cost much." "That is true," she replied. "It is not the cost. But if they have just one, they will learn to give up to one another." So the children shared a single bicycle. Amazingly enough, the four children probably grew up with a level of creature comforts not that far above what Rockefeller had known as a boy. Except on Sundays, the girls wore simple gingham dresses and hand-me-downs. In later life, John Jr. confessed sheepishly that until the age of 8 he wore only dresses, because he was the youngest child and the 3 older siblings were girls. Rockefeller's home secretary saw much of the children because they liked to sit quietly and observe the mysterious clicking of the telegraph wires in her office. She described Rockefeller as extremely gentle with the children, but attached to certain fixed principles that he expounded with didactic, wearying repetition. The children were told so often that cards were sinful that they couldn't distinguish one card suit from another. To teach self-restraint, Rockefeller limited them to one piece of cheese daily. One afternoon, little Alta tattled on her younger sister Edith for having eaten 2 pieces of cheese, and Rockefeller professed shock at this epicurean indulgence. As the secretary recalled, "All that afternoon, whenever Edith came within hearing, her father would say slowly and impressively, 'Edith was greedy.' At another time, both little John and Alta called out, 'Edith took the biggest.' Repeatedly that afternoon, Mr. Rockefeller said in his impressive manner, 'Edith was selfish.' Yet the thing to be husbanded most jealously was time. One could neither be too early nor too late. In fact, there was such a fetish about punctuality that it occasioned discernible anxiety among the children. Rockefeller's home secretary said that John Jr. had computed, down to the second, how long it took to get from her telegraph office to the schoolroom upstairs. After that, whenever I read to the children near school time, John would sit with watch in hand, and his rising was signal for the reading to stop and for the girls to follow him. Each morning before breakfast, Rockefeller led the family in prayer, meting out a penny fine to latecomers. Everyone took turns reciting from Scripture, and John Orsetti elucidated difficult portions and prayed for guidance. Before bed, Setti listened to the children recite their prayers, and nothing could divert her from this sacred duty. They were encouraged to be active in prayer, especially at Friday night prayer meetings. As John Jr. recalled, at an early age they were encouraged to take part like the older people, either in a brief word of prayer or a word of personal experience. Sunday was a heavily regimented day, starting with morning prayers and Sunday school, then proceeding through afternoon prayer meetings and culminating with evening hymns. If the children had spare time, they couldn't read novels or worldly literature, but had to restrict themselves to the Bible and Sunday school literature. Strangely enough, the